his joint work with Bob Bago at Maryland. So I'm going to be talking about an equation which is actually very old. And the equation is supposed, I mean, the cartoon that you're supposed to keep in your mind is of a system with many particles, but somehow there is no spatial variation in the system. And all one is sort of interested in is in the statistics of the distribution of sizes of the particles. Okay, so with apologies to those of you who've heard this joke several times before, one way of thinking about the system is to think about it as survival of the fattest. So you have a bunch of particles, and then, you know, only the fat ones will survive in the end. The other joke, of course, is that this is a model for Reaganomics, or sort of inverse, or the robber baron economy, where you take from the poor and you give to the rich. Okay, so I won't say anything more about my politics after this. Okay, so the equations are actually really simple. So the only sort of dynamics in there are sort of completely subsumed into this kernel. Is there a pointer? Ah, okay. All the dynamics is completely subsumed into this kernel K. It's a big problem to find out what this kernel K is, but let's just assume that it's given to us. So what we do is we study the number of clusters of mass X at time T per unit volume. And the increase of, you have a growth term and you have a decay term. The growth term is caused by the fact that a particle of size Y can meet a particle of size X minus Y to give you a particle of size X, and then you integrate over all of that. And at the same time, if one of your guys hits any other person, you lose. Okay, so this is the rule for the evolution of the distribution. It turns out that Smoluchowski's paper has sort of got an extensive scientific literature that goes with it. Smoluchowski's 1917 paper, which was sort of written shortly before his death in the Spanish flu epidemic at the end of World War I, is sort of one of the 50 most cited papers, but somehow it hasn't attracted as much mathematical attention as it should have. So here are some sort of typical kernels that come up, and okay, this is too much to absorb, but let's just say that it comes up in several applications. One thing that you should observe is that all these kernels are homogeneous, and there's a degree of homogeneity gamma, and this will play a critical role in what I'm going to talk about. Okay, so here's a sort of heuristic field. So I should say that Smoluchowski was interested in the coagulation of colloids. Okay, so you have a bunch of colloidal particles, and they're sort of moving around and they're hitting each other. And he was interested in sort of coagulation driven by Brownian motion. Okay, and so X over here is the size of a particle. You're living in three dimensions, so the size goes, the radius of the particle goes as the size to, you know, so this is the size of a particle of mass X. Okay, and there's two terms. So big particles move slowly because of the Stokes-Einstein relationship. I'm sorry, this should be, okay, let's say the Stokes-Einstein is what it's more commonly called. And this is a measure of the size of the particle, which is sort of collision cross-section. Okay, so these are, let's say, some typical kernels that one talks about. Let me just give you a heuristic feel for what the equations do. Okay, so for simplicity, let's just consider that we're starting with an initial condition which is monodispersed. So I only start off with clusters of size 1. So now clusters of size 1 meet other clusters of size 1 and form clusters of size 2. These meet clusters of size 3, you get the idea. Okay, so if this is a picture of the time evolution of the system, the blue sort of denotes the starting initial condition, so everything is in clusters of size 1. A little bit of time later, the mass is sort of escaping into larger and larger cluster sizes. Okay, so there's an infinite speed of propagation. The equation develops, the distribution develops a non-trivial tail immediately. Okay, so the normalization over here is that the mass of clusters is the first moment. Okay, so we study a number density. So the first moment of that is the mass. So the first moment is going to be conserved, and all moments higher than that are going to grow. Let me just sort of show you sort of typical, an example of what could happen. Okay, so, you know, everything is moving into larger and larger cluster sizes. And in a sense, the asymptotic dynamics are trivial. Everything has gone into a cluster of infinite size. So what you'd like to know is how this happens. But there's a little problem that you have to worry about, and the problem is that if somehow your kernel favors large interactions, so you form large clusters, and these large clusters meet other large clusters with sort of a high frequency, then you can have runaway growth. Okay, so this need not be undesirable. If the problem that one is interested in is the kinetics of polymerization, then you would like the systems to sort of form a gel in finite time. And so the sort of classic example in this case is due to Bryce McLeod from the 60s. The kernel he chooses is the multiplicative kernel. And I'm not showing you the complete solution, which I might later. But all you should sort of observe from this is that what I'm doing is I'm just writing out equations for the evolution of the moments. The first moment over there is the mass, and the mass should formally be conserved. And indeed, if you plug into the equations, what you see is you get a term like m2 squared minus m2 squared, which should morally be zero, but there's a problem. The problem is that the second moment grows too fast, and it blows up at time t is equal to, blow up at time t is equal to 1. That's a typo. Okay, so the zeroth moment is decreasing, the first moment is formally constant, and the second moment just blows up. Okay, so one way of sort of formalizing this problem is to sort of look for, you know, so there's a well-posedness problem that goes with this, and what you'd like to do is to say that, you know, find conditions so that sort of mass, so that a higher moment blows up in finite time. But somehow the more natural way to think about it is to say that find the critical time so that the mass of the system is no longer conserved after this critical time. Somehow it goes into an infinite gel. Okay. Another sort of cute little thing that you can notice from this explicit calculation is that the second moment just sort of decreases linearly, at least if the mass is formally conserved. Okay, and this is a problem because if mass were conserved after this, it would become negative at some point of time. And of course, this is a moment of a positive distribution, and this shouldn't happen. Okay, and this can be exploited for general kernels. So let me sort of start telling you about what the mathematical questions are that go with this. Let me just give you an example. So one of the examples is in polymerization. And typically what people do is they sort of augment your model after the critical time by some additional rule. So, I mean, either you change the model, let's say you cheat and you change the model to fix the problem after gelation time. There is a sort of natural rule which is sort of like looking for an entropy solution after a shock formation, but it's not clear whether this is the right rule. So here are, let's say, some mathematical questions. Okay, the first one is somehow just to resolve this problem. So, you know, when is the system well-posed and what are conditions for gelation? So for a long time, you know, this example of McLeod was the only known explicit example. And sort of the question was finally settled by Gion in his PhD thesis at Ohio State in 1998 by probabilistic methods. Okay, and he sort of proved in full generality that if the sort of degree of homogeneity of the kernel is greater than 1, then you have gelation. Okay, there's an L1 theory, and now sort of the state of the art can be found last year in the paper of Escobedo, Mishler, and Pertam, which is an L1 theory for the case where you've got both coagulation and fragmentation. Okay. Somehow the jury is still not quite out on this completely, because as it will sort of turn out, measure-valued solutions are somehow the right thing to look at. Okay, but the main reason that there's been sort of a remarkable sort of rise in the literature on the subject was because of work of probabilists in the 90s, largely by Aldous, and there's an influential survey article by Aldous, which is sort of web downloadable. Okay, I don't have the web citation, but search for David Aldous on Google and you'll get his homepage and it's all there. And here the questions are, okay, so the first thing is somehow there's some sort of implicit probabilistic dynamics in this. Okay, we've got a bunch of clusters, they bang into each other. So you want to come up with a Markov process and sort of find a weak law of large numbers for this Markov process. So this is called the Markov-Lushnikov process, and there are sort of various questions associated to this that probabilists are interested in. A second question which sort of seems, or a third question in this list, which seems quite hard to tackle in full generality is the sort of question of hydrodynamic limits. I mean, in fact, it's still not known whether Smoluchowski's equation can be derived from first principles by, let's say, a sort of Brownian motion among Poissonian obstacles. So you have a bunch of particles moving around, you know, can you sort of find a hydrodynamic limit? Okay, the question that I'm going to be talking about is sort of somewhere in between these, sort of we are analysts and or some approximation to that. And what we were interested in was the question of sort of self-similarity in these equations, and or in sort of physical lingo, dynamical scaling. So, okay, we know that all the mass is going to infinite mass clusters. The question is, how does this happen in finite time? I mean, does it approach a self-similar? Does it approach a self-similar form? Sort of embarrassingly, little is known about the problem. Okay, so I showed you this fancy table of kernels that one is interested in. Okay, and the only kernels for which we have any kind of results are for these, which are called the solvable kernels, because you can solve them. I mean, this is not so bad, because there's a very rich mathematical theory that goes with this. And okay, I don't know how much of the probability I'll be able to touch on, but it's really quite remarkable what the probabilists have done. Okay, and so basically what turns out in this case is that the Laplace transform of Smoluchowski's equation can be solved explicitly, and from this you can try and sort of prove results on convergence to self-similar form. Okay, so prior results over here, there's a result of Creer and Penrose on locally uniform convergence. It's a little technical, and there's also a slightly later result of Diaconu and Tonge. Okay, so let me sort of tell you what was known. Okay, so this is the table from Aldous's survey article. It's not, I mean, okay, the explicit form of the solutions is not of so much interest. So these are the known self-similar solutions. If you want to prove convergence to self-similar form, you start by finding self-similar solutions and then trying to sort of show that you have convergence to these. Okay, so the way that people sort of did this was, okay, you start with monodisperse initial conditions, you find an explicit solution. So that's what you have over there. Okay, it's hard because solving for a Laplace transform is really easy, but inverting a Laplace transform is a mess. Okay, so that's why it's only these that were known. But on the other hand, once you have these solutions, you can take limits as time goes to infinity, and you can find self-similar solutions. Okay, so these are the self-similar solutions. Okay, so what are the problems with this? Okay, there's one good thing, which is not a problem, which is that these two kernels are very closely related. Okay, the self-similar forms are, self-similar solutions are exactly the same form. Okay, so the first remark is that the self-similar solutions have exponential decay. The second thing is the scaling is chosen to preserve mass for these two, because these are mass-preserving solutions. When k is equal to xy, you have gelation, so you sort of look for a conservation of another moment. The problem is that these solutions for a long time were thought to be unphysical. The reason being that in this case, you have okay, the square root actually should extend all the way to the x cubed, so it's sort of an x raised to 3/2. You've got too many small clusters. It's the number distribution is diverging like x raised to 3/2 at 0, or x raised to minus 3/2 at 0, and so the number of clusters is infinite. Okay, that's not so bad because the mass is what's important, but somehow when you go to the next kernel, the mass also diverges. Okay, so you'd like to know, you know, if these things are typical, or, you know, if they're really unphysical. Okay, let me just sort of give you a quick probabilistic cartoon and relate it a little bit to, at least in spirit, to what David Candelaria spoke about yesterday. So we are interested in these, you know, so to give you an example of model of coalescence, I mean, there was something that he did yesterday. Okay, so let's start with a random process. Let's say a Poisson point process. And then we make... I think this is right. You have a Voronoi tessellation of, okay, so you get, okay, let's say, okay, it's better to probably draw the, you know, okay, you get the idea. You've got a bunch of particles of various sizes. Okay, and you have sort of rules, you have rules for evolution which sort of wipe out the edges. Okay, it's kind of hard to study this. So what you do is you make things simpler by choosing a one-dimensional model. So your state space is not R2, but just the line. And now you choose a point process over here. Okay, now you have a rule for sort of the vanishing of these points. Okay, if the points vanish, then you've got intervals of certain lengths over here. And what you could do is study the length size distribution of these. So there's several French statistical physicists who studied models of this kind. And then there's also a big article by Bray. And essentially what you do is you sort of make a system of rules. You make a system of rules, and depending upon the system of rules, you look for self-similar solutions. Now, what's the simplest possible rule that you could make? The simplest possible rule is that you say that you sort of, you have these marks over here, and the marks disappear independently, and somehow independently and with a rate chosen to be a certain function. Okay, so here's an explicit probabilistic construction of this, which is due to Aldous and Pittman, and it's exactly the picture that I drew in the book. Okay, so you start off with a point process on the line. So, these are just sort of points which come from some distribution. And then each of these points has a line, has a clock that goes with it. And when the clock sort of rings, it dies, and you don't see it anymore. So as time increases, some of the points survive, some of them don't. But what you see is that the gaps between the intervals grow larger and larger. Okay, so it turns out that sort of if you start with a Poisson point process and you thin the process at the right rate, you get a solution to Smoluchowski's equation. Okay, and this is kind of good because it suggests that several probabilistic methods might be useful in the problem. Okay, let me speed up and get to, well, not speed up, but let me get to where I really want to go. Okay, so we're studying the solvable kernel, so that's only three kernels. And finding self-similar solutions is actually quite easy. Okay, so you make the right change of variables. You have to be a little careful because the number distribution over here diverges. And so you sort of, you cheat a little bit and you cheat a little bit in your answers. Okay, so the equations that you get are very simple. So for the constant kernel, you get that equation, which, it's hard work, but you can solve it. This one is, even harder, but again, you can solve it. Okay, it's Berger. I mean, you can solve this stuff. It's easy. Okay. So all you have to do is make the right ansatz, and now you have to make the right change of variables, you make the right ansatz, and it turns out that you don't have just one self-similar solution, not just the one with exponential tails, but in fact, you have an entire family of these. So you have a one-parameter family of self-similar solutions. Okay, they have representations of this kind. This equation is slightly bad. It's an implicit equation. You can solve it by a series solution, which we did, but somehow this is the wrong century for a series solution. But okay, I mean, it turned out not to be so stupid because we could find. In the end, it sort of gave us some insights. Okay. So the question is: so these are the self-similar solutions. The question is, how do you sort of prove approach to the self-similar solutions? So there's a very classical theorem to use at this point, which is that if you get pointwise convergence of the Laplace transforms, you get weak convergence of measures. Okay, so let's just consider one very special case. Okay, so here's the black line over there is the actual self-similar solution. The red line is the self-similar solution. Pick one. The other one is phi of TS in suitably rescaled variables. And now what you'd like to do is to sort of prove that this one converges to that one. And somehow the condition that they're tangent to the origin just reflects the fact that they have the same mass and, let's say, same higher moment. Okay, so the basic mechanism is somehow that these things are very close at the origin. And when looked at the right way, one sort of has this sort of hyperbolic equation in the characteristic plane, and somehow it's what you have to do is you have to sort of take your error over here and flow it out. And so we took sort of a long time to get the right idea on how exactly to sort of find a complete answer for convergence to self-similar form, but let me just tell you the theorem. Okay, so it's basically, the heuristic is that you've got a good error estimate of the origin, and somehow it's pushing up. Okay, but here's the theorem. Okay, so our main theorem is necessary and sufficient conditions for convergence to self-similar form. It's sort of a long theorem, but let me sort of say that the first part of here is just essentially a statement of weak continuity of measures. This is the critical condition. It says that you have weak convergence of measures if and only if the tail of the initial distribution has a certain specific form. Okay, one doesn't have enough time for a proof, but let me at least give you an explanation. Okay, so the first thing is the theorem is somehow entirely analogous to the characterization of domains of attraction in central limit theorem. more fancy language for this is universality classes for dynamical scaling in physical, I mean, in let's say physics Lego. Okay, so the picture is something like this. So this is the Laplace transform. And what we'd like is somehow for the Laplace transform to converge to the right Laplace, I mean, to converge to the Laplace transform of the self-similar distribution. Well, okay, so let's just look at the simple case where the equation of evolution is something like this. So clearly there's a decay in the evolution. So if I didn't rescale stuff, as I let time go to infinity, what would happen is that everything would just squash down to zero. Okay, you don't want to do that, so you have to recompensate in some way by stretching. Okay, so the basic mechanism is just a sort of interplay between the decay over here and the stretching. And it turns out that, okay, this is sort of essentially exactly the mechanism that governs attraction to, let's say, the central limit theorem. So either one has the option of, you know, somehow trying to recapture 60 years of probabilistic limit theorem, or you sort of take the other solution, which is to lock yourself in your office and read Seller's book really carefully. I somehow chose the second. So it turns out that it's all there. Okay, so the ingredients in the proof are, as I said, just the sort of following classical fact that pointwise convergence of Laplace or Fourier transforms is equivalent to the convergence of measures. Wait, and this one? Okay. And the second fact is somehow you have to choose exactly the right class of functions. Okay, so if you're doing something like this, you can believe that if you have a power law, then clearly you know how to choose the timescale. The problem is that what happens if you have, you know, essentially all you're going to do is keep blowing up a small neighborhood of this point. Well, a neighborhood of the point in Laplace space by Tauberian theorems is the same as the behavior of the tails of your initial distribution. And somehow you have to worry about what if my tails, you know, what if instead of a pure power law, if it's got a logarithm or a logarithm of a logarithm. It turns out that all of this sort of goes into the class of regularly or the class of slowly varying functions, and everything is contained within that. Okay. Let me say that somehow the main point I would like to make is that the analogy with sort of classical probabilistic theorems is much deeper than this. And somehow to prove the weak convergence theorem the weak convergence theorem, though it appears quite simple, is actually absolutely fundamental. Okay, so the first thing is, what if you want to refine your convergence theorems? Well, there's sort of very well-established technology for this. So, for example, the basic game that you play is, so let's just look at the complex half-plane. What I proved is weak convergence or pointwise convergence over here. Well, that implies pointwise convergence on the half-plane, and in fact, it implies pointwise convergence on the closed half-plane. Well, the Fourier transform lives over here, okay? And so somehow, if you can prove sort of L1 convergence on this axis, then you get uniform convergence measures. So the basic game that you play is you sort of add on moment or regularity assumptions, and from this you can get sort of more refined convergence theorems. So large deviations estimate sort of means in the classical sense, as one would find. Okay, but somehow the deeper a deeper understanding of this sort of comes out of work of Bertrand, who's a French probabilist. And so what he sort of noticed was this beautiful analogy between the classical theorems and probabilities, sort of the classical characterization of infinitely divisible laws, and somehow the sort of self-similar solutions to Smoluchowski's equation. And the connection is between sort of is through this Levi-Kinchin characterization. I could sort of tell you about that later, but let me just tell you, let me just sort of give you the application and maybe explain it in a second. So the application is, okay, so the application is quite striking, and it's a sort of complete solution to the problem of Berger's equation with random initial data. So the problem, so we all know Berger's equation, and we all know that there's a rule for the solution of Berger's equation, which is the Hopfield solution. Okay, so somehow one would like to know what the statistics are of solutions to Berger's equation with random initial data. So Berger himself was interested, I mean, in this problem. So after all, he sort of came up with this equation as a model for turbulence, and he was interested in the case of white noise. Okay, and this was sort of tackled more rigorously later by Marco Avellaneda and Wayne Anna. Okay, so what Bertrand did is sort of give a very simple and elegant solution to the problem in the case when the initial data is either a Levy stable process or Levy stable noise or Brownian motion. Okay, so these are somehow the sort of fundamental probabilistic processes that you should choose, because the assumptions that we've got when we're building up models of this kind is that somehow the process is stationary in space. Okay, so you want stationary with independent increments, and this is exactly a Levy process. Okay, so here's a cartoon of what we are trying to do. Okay, the condition to the left is sort of technical, and it can be wiped out. Okay, so this is the typical initial data. Okay, so the Hopkins solution, what you do is you make a potential out of this initial data, and you solve for the inverse Lagrangian function. Okay, so that's essentially sort of a geometric statement of fitting a straight line to this parabola. Okay, I should tell you at least something about the Levy-Kinchin characterization to... Okay, let me, since I'm sort of almost out of time, let me just tell you what the picture is. So we're starting with random initial data to Berger's equation. So this is U0x equal to random process. Okay, and we have a rule for the evolution of the process, which is the Hopkins solution. Okay, so at any time t, if I want to find out my solution, it comes out of the Hopkins solution. Well, if you want to prescribe the random process completely in the case where the initial data is, let's say, Brownian motion or a Levy process, all you have to do is to prescribe a positive measure. Okay, well, in precisely you have to prescribe a sort of Levy pair, but let's just think of the fact that you've got a positive measure. Okay, we have a rule for the evolution of this measure, which is Smoluchowski's equation. Okay, so the miracle that happens is, so instead of sort of solving the equation over there, you solve Smoluchowski's equation over here, march up to time t, look at, you sort of know at time t the Levy-Kinchin representation, and this tells you essentially everything about the statistics of the solution. So in particular, it tells you about the statistics of the shocks, and if you've got a convergence theorem over here, which is weak convergence of measures, you can make it a convergence theorem over here in the right sort of topology, which is this cohort topology, and so you get a weak convergence theorem for sort of, let's say, necessary and sufficient conditions for equilibration of shock statistics in Berger's equation, essentially by solving this problem over here. Okay, so there's one fact which is okay. So this measure is not something which is arbitrary. What it does is it measures the sizes of the jumps in the process. So it's measuring the sizes of the shocks, and it's critical that the initial measure that you choose be supported on the positive half line. Somehow, if you start off Berger's equation with random initial data with negative jumps, then you have rarefaction waves. And rarefaction waves cause correlations in space. So in the particular case that you start with initial data which has positive jumps, the data always stays sort of, it always stays a Levy process for all times. Okay, so the sort of slightly deeper reason for this is the fact that one can think of Berger's equation somehow as a process of ballistic aggregation. Okay, so sticky particles. So at each moment what you're doing is when two particles meet, you're conserving you're conserving momentum and mass, but you're not conserving energy, and this sort of is encoded over here. Okay, there is, our results don't apply to white noise, but there is sort of a quite sophisticated understanding of this due to Bertrand and his student, Christophe Giraud. Okay, let me sort of summarize, because I guess I'm out of time. So, first part is, okay, so classical methods of probability theory work extremely well. Okay, there's no doubt that this is absolutely sort of the right way to do the problem. So the first part is, regular variation is the right tool to give you domains of attraction. And in some sense, okay, these methods have been developed by probabilists, but really it's sort of analytical lemmas, and all you really need is sort of this fundamental fact that regular variation, the rigidity lemma for regular variation. Okay, this is philosophy, so let's skip that. Okay, so what I should say that it's not just these models that I showed you, but essentially there's a whole bunch of sort of coagulation models which are with explicit solutions. And the situation is something like, if you can find an explicit solution, then you can find, then at least now we know that, you know, we have the right tools to prove convergence to self-similar form in quite a simple way. Okay, the toy models are surprisingly robust within full PD problems. What I really mean is something of that kind over there. There's an analogy for the constant kernel, but I won't, there's no need to talk about that. Okay, but somehow, you know, this is it. You use these methods and you get an explicit solution and you can do stuff, but there's nothing you can do for other kernels. I mean, we don't know how to do it. You get some sort of, the existence problem for solid looks a little like existence problems for solitary waves, but somehow it's not that easy to. Okay, I mean, we just don't know how to do it. The problem's been open for a long time. Okay, so I went over time, but.